Hi everyone, I'm Vinay Kumar, a Sabre member from San Diego, and apologies for the technical difficulties. My laptop screen actually stopped working yesterday, and so I'm struggling a little bit. Just a second, let me get this back. All right. The resolution's not quite. Should do it. There we go. All right. So the study of my talk, or the purpose of my talk, is to look at the talent differential in the AL versus the NL. So the AL and NL have been rival leagues for 120 years now, and it's often been a hotly debated topic: which league is better. That actually was the start. That was the premise of the World Series, was a face-off between the two leagues. And then with the introduction of the All-Star Game and interleague play, baseball fans have had plenty of opportunities to argue about and debate which league is better. And it's not just fans. The media talk about it all the time. So we heard a lot about the AL dominating interleague play over the last 10 or 15 years at various times. And they've lately dominated the All-Star Game, too. And I don't mean to pick on the NL here. I'm actually an NL fan. The NL had a great run of dominance in All-Star Games, too. There's a lot of talk that people do. There's a lot of, rhetoric and arguing. But analysts have looked at this, too. So here's our very own Chuck Hildebrandt from Sabre, who gave a talk a few years ago looking at the same topic. And he had a really cool idea to look at it. So he looked at players who moved leagues from one league to the other. And then he said, how do they do when they switch to the new league? Do they do better or worse than anticipated? And if you look at which set of players do better and which do worse, is there a pattern in the AL or the NL? And what he found is that players struggled more in the AL, and they did well in the NL. And so the inference was that the AL was a stronger league at that time. And actually, he wasn't the first person to do that. You don't have to worry about reading this graph, but this is a 40-year-old graph done by Dick Kramer, also of Sabre, that was published in The Hidden Game of Baseball in 1983, where he did a similar thing, looking at players who switched leagues and tried to infer the level of quality of each of those leagues. And so I've always been intrigued by both of these studies. I mean, I've been thinking about Chuck's since then. I read about Dick's when I was a little kid, and I still remember it. And so I wanted to look at this problem a little further. And so the two methods were similar, but they faced the same constraint. They were limited to the players who switched leagues, which is only a small fraction of the players that are there. So you're making an inference about a large pool of players from the small pool of players who changed teams. And that might not even be a representative set of players. There may be reasons that they've changed leagues. And so it's hard to draw conclusions. And so Chuck was very careful. He said at the time, it appears that the AL is much stronger, but I can't say by how much. I don't know when it became stronger. You can't really detect changes year to year. So that's what I wanted to look at. And my big aha moment is that interleague play changed everything. Because now it's as if players change leagues all the time. They don't really switch leagues all the time, but they're playing across the leagues. And so as you have players playing against both leagues, you can start to make inferences. The same ideas of looking at how do they do against the different leagues when they move, you can actually do that with their splits. So as an example, here's Joey Votto, a player we all know and mostly love. And he's played his entire career for one team in one league, the Reds in the NL. But thanks to interleague play, we can see that, and this is through 2020, so the numbers are actually increased now, he has nearly 900 plate appearances, that's probably close to 1,000 now, against the American League. So though he never switched teams or switched leagues, we have more than a full season of playing time that he's amassed in the AL, and then of course the 15 seasons of playing time in the NL. And if you look at those numbers, he's done a little bit better against the NL. And that shouldn't be surprising, that's his home league. So I wouldn't infer too much, it's not a huge difference, and there's a whole host of reasons he could do better in the NL than the AL. Like I said, those are the pitchers he's familiar against, and he's faced them more. This is 15 years of data. The pitchers in both leagues have changed a ton over that time. Votto has changed over that time. He's aged. And so this is an interesting data point, but it's one data point, and I wouldn't infer anything about the AL versus NL based on one data point, especially when in Votto's case it's over 15 years of data, and like I said, everything has been changing over that time. But Votto is one player, and we have practically every hitter in Major League Baseball facing pitching in both leagues in every year, so we can make inferences based on that. Similarly, every pitcher faces hitters in both leagues practically every year, so we can look at their splits. So before I dive too far in, I want to just clarify, what am I trying to measure and what am I not? And so what I really wanted to look at are the talent levels of the pitchers and the position playing hitters in each league. And so I excluded any plate appearances by DHs, pinch hitters, and pitchers. And I don't want to say those don't matter. They're extremely important in terms of the quality of the teams, but they're so different, like the roster construction between AL and NL teams, that when you try to when you include DHs and pitch hitters and pinch hitters, it just kind of throws everything off. And so what I said is, we know those things varied differently, I mean, across the leagues greatly until this year, now that we have the universal DH. But let's focus on the pitchers, and let's focus on the position players and how they bat while they're in games in which they field. And then I wanted to look at the relative talent difference between the leagues. So I'm just comparing the two leagues to each other and seeing which has better hitters and pitchers. I'm not looking at how much it changes over time. So, you know, people say hitting is so much harder now. I don't know. I didn't even attempt to look. It's really hard to look at changes across time. But within a given year, or within a little bit, that's easier. And I think this is going to get cut off. Yeah, so the last part, I just started to get into it. I want to see how these differences have changed over time. And so that was really important to me, because I of course they're going to change over time. I think that's very likely. And so I didn't want to look at the entirety of the last 15 years or 25 years. I wanted to be able to look at any given point in time, where do the leagues stand relative to each other then? And so for that reason, I looked at each three-year window. So I looked at 1997 to 1999, then 98 to 2000, and so on all the way to 2018 to 2020. So we can see how things change over time. And so again, how are we going to do this? If you remember the Votto example, we looked at his splits against AL pitchers and NL pitchers. And again, I would never base anything off of one player's split, so I'm not even going to kind of look at that. But instead, these are all the hitters in baseball between 2017 and 2019. And I don't worry about, there's no overarching message of this graph, but what I want to show is like how we can look at all of the hitters. And so each dot represents one hitter. The size of the dot is how much playing time he had against both leagues. And the color of the dot is whether he did better against the AL or the NL. And let me go to a couple examples. So here's Miguel Cabrera. And the number there is WOBA. It's an offensive stat developed by Tom Tango about 20 years ago. If you don't know it, don't worry too much. It's just a good overall measure of offense. The scale is kind of like on-base percentage, where 320 is about league average. So Miguel Cabrera was already a pretty old player by this time, but you can see he had 312 against the AL, 315 against the NL, almost identical. And then the minimum PAs, that means he had 126 PAs against the National League. So he obviously had a lot more against the AL, but we want to weight him. We want to look at his you know, the smaller sample against the NL and say, okay, he had 126 plate appearances against them. And so what we're going to do is we're going to create an aggregate picture, like an aggregate pool of all the players. And so how do we combine the different players into the pool? We take that the lower of the number of plate appearances they had. So like I said, Cabrera had 126 plate appearances against the NL. So he's going to count for 126 plate appearances in our pool. And we can look at a number of different players. So here's somebody up here who hit a lot better against the NL, Eugenio Suarez, who hit 277 against the AL, 381 against the NL. So that's somebody who, again, one data point doesn't tell us much, but when we aggregate him in the pool, we're going to see his stats against the NL and the stats against the AL, prorated to 247 plate appearances. Then we have these little dots, like Yunel Escobar, who wasn't a regular player. So even though he hit great against the NL, you know, it's only 28 plate appearances, so we're going to include him in our pool. There's no minimum plate appearance cutoff I used, but just the lower of the plate appearances against the AL or the NL, that's how much you contribute to the pool. And so what we do is we take all of these players, all these thousands of players, their AL and NL splits, scale them down to the same number of at-bats, and then pool them together. And when we do this for all the position player batters, there's a way to get this to work. I will read this to you, except I can't read it on my screen either. But what it says there, there are two lines. It says versus AL and versus NL. And there are 75,515 plate appearances in each pool. So that's a lot of at-bats. So we go from this problem of only having, you know, a half dozen players switching leagues. Now we're looking at every player across baseball. And even looking at the lower of the number of PAs, when we add them up, we get 75,515 PAs. And the part I really wish you could see, though, are the BA, OBP, slugging, and WOBA. And I'm trying to think if there's a way to be creative right now. And I can think of one, which is, I can just get out of presentation mode and just show you my work. So, like I said, 75,515 plate appearances. And there's a slight difference in BA, OBP, slugging, and WOBA, which sums it all up. So, over those years, the players hit 3 points better against the WOBA, I mean against the AL by WOBA. So what does this mean? We have this gigantic pool of players, practically every position player who played then, weighted by how much playing time they got against both leagues. And this tells us, and it's the same pool, every player is represented exactly the same in this pool. And we have their AL split and their NL split. And then I actually even looked, is there any bias? Even though it's the same set of players, might there be a reason we expect them to do better in the versus AL pool than the versus NL pool? So I don't have the details all here, but I looked at parks, I looked at aging, I looked at platoon advantage, and there was nothing. This is the same exact set of hitters in the same exact set of conditions on average. And they hit a little better against the AL than they did against the NL. And my inference there, and this is a small gap, so it's not a huge difference, is that the NL pitchers were stronger in those years than the AL pitchers. By enough, not a huge amount, just enough for that 3-point gap. You can do a similar thing, and lots of people have done this with AAA in the majors, and you'll get much bigger gaps. So 3 points is a small gap, but that's the inference we're making, that the pitchers in the NL were slightly better than in the AL. And we can repeat that. That was the last 3 years. That was 2017 to 2019. This is what it is over time, over the entire interleague era. And I'll start with the data point we were just looking at, which is 2017 to 2019. And so you can see there, when it says AL, that's what the AL pitchers gave up. And NL is what the NL pitchers gave up. So lower is better. And so the NL was better by 3 points. But that is only a recent phenomenon. Only in the last 2 years, or sorry, the last 2-3 year windows, have the NL pitchers fared better. What it actually appears is that the AL pitchers have been significantly better than the NL for pretty much the entire interleague era. And this was a really bit sizable gap in the mid-2000s. So that's a 14-point gap in WOBA. So that's the difference between, you know, kind of an above-average player versus a below-average starter. It's not, you know, it's not saying that the AL is all stars compared to the NL, but that on average there was a significant difference in the pitchers, and it showed up in how the hitters hit in interleague play. Now we can do the exact same thing, but flip it and look at how did the pitchers do against the batters of each league, and I did that. And it's exactly the same math, so I'm not going to show you the same bubble chart, but it works out the same. You've got all these pitchers contributing a different amount. And so when you look at this, and I don't know why this one data point isn't showing up here, but it's kind of flat if I looked at the numbers. And so here, you know, we have kind of, the gap isn't as big, but here higher is better because these are the batters. So this is what, we have a standard pool of pitchers now, and What did the NL batters and the AL batters hit against that standard pool of pitchers? And the AL batters, year after year, were hitting for about 3 to 5 points of WOBA higher. So, and you know, again, peaking around this mid-2000s era. And then again, the NL appeared to catch up within the last few years. So again, not as big a gap as with the pitchers, but it appears that the AL has been better than the NL for most of this time, and that the NL has made up the gap in the last few years. So on both sides of the ball. And that's actually one thing that was interesting to me, that you could separate out hitters and pitchers and look at them. And there's no reason, well, I don't know, but to me, I think it's a coincidence that they kind of cross lines at the same time. It could have been that the AL had better pitching and the NL had better hitting, or vice versa. So I don't know, and I didn't get into why. I didn't look at systemic reasons. The AL payrolls were higher for most of this time, but not for all of this time. But what's interesting is that both the hitting pool and the pitching pool appear to be better in the AL over that time. And I'm going to skip down a little, because the next question that everybody has is like, well, this isn't super surprising, because the AL was kicking butt in interleague play this entire time. And there was a lot of questions about why. Are there systemic reasons? But, you know, this was really cool for me to look at. Well, maybe it's just no more complicated than the players were better. So what I wanted to look at next, and you're going to have to allow me to scroll past a lot of numbers and code and some graphs that I didn't use for this, is this consistent with what we've seen in interleague records? So the blue line is the actual interleague records. It's how many games above or 500 the AL was. And I just picked the AL because they were winning most of that time and positive numbers are easier to think about. And the red line is what we would expect. So if we took those two previous graphs of what was the difference between the batters and the pitchers, I mean, sorry, between the AL and the NL in batting and in pitching, and then you combine those, you can convert those differences in WOBA into expected runs per game. And then you can go from expected runs per game for pitchers and hitters, and you can actually turn it into a winning percentage. And so I was able to compute what is the expected winning percentage in interleague play. And you get this red line. And so I think this is actually really interesting because it shows, you know, when the AL was doing better, you know, when they were dominating, we see that the talent difference was biggest. And as it goes, like these lines move together a lot. Not perfectly. There's a lot more noise in the interleague play because it's only a couple hundred games a year. Whereas for the player pools, like I said, what we saw before, we're looking at tens of thousands of plate appearances. But it's definitely a bigger gap. Like, it seems like the blue line gets to higher points and lower points. So it's like there's something more going on in interleague play that I'm not capturing here, which is fine because I already said there's a number of things we're not looking at, like roster construction, like DHs. But there was one last thing I did decide to look at. Maybe it's still here. And I thought maybe the win-loss records, you know, like I said, they're noisy. So I looked at the run differential rather than just the win-loss records. And so the blue line is the actual run differential in interleague games. And the red line is what we would expect based on the talent pool. So the red line is actually the same as on the previous graph. It's just a slightly different scale. And those are really close. So I think that actually made me feel a little better. I think this takes a little bit of the noise out. They still don't explain all the difference. There's still a pretty big gap here and here. So there's some, like I said, there was something going on that made the AL do even better in interleague play than we can infer from looking at the stats of the players. And so that's the basic punchline. But kind of what's next? What do we do with this information? So the one thing that I thought of, and people talked about this at the time when the AL was a lot better, that, you know, are the stats a true measure of how the player is doing? We always know that there are distortions in the stats. We know to adjust them for things like park and era. So I think that's the one more thing we need to think about. And so the question is, should we league adjust stats? And I would say that's kind of on the right track, but I would take it one step further. And what you really need to do is competition adjust stats. So every player is facing a different mix of competition. So even if you're in the stronger AL, well, when it was stronger, now it's the NL, some teams and some players are facing tougher mixes of opponents than others. And even within the same team, there's a lot of luck for starting pitchers especially. So I know like Baseball Reference WAR actually looks at each pitcher's mix of opponents and takes that into account. But I know of no other stats that do that. And I think that's the right direction to go. So not just an AL versus NL adjustment. And that's kind of hard to, you know, computationally it's a little expensive to look at for each batter what's the set of all pitchers that they faced and what's the average. But we do all this stuff on computers every day. I mean, WAR is recalculated every night. Everybody looks at it. Very few people really understand all the adjustments that go into it. We trust the people and the community have done as good a job as we can to get there. And then we just basically believe the numbers that pop out. So I would say, for the most part, it's not something that you have to think about a lot. But we adjust for park in WAR. We should adjust for other, you know, we can adjust for competition as well. And like I said, Baseball Reference does for pitchers, but I think it would be great to do so for hitters as well. And the last question is something I skipped there. And then just acknowledgments. I'd like to thank Chuck and Dick for their earlier work here. It really inspired me. And like I said, made me want to build upon it. And it was kind of cool to see it mostly agree with what Chuck said, but to be able to actually see the gaps and see the changes in time. A huge thanks to RetroSheet and Baseball Data Bank for all the data. And there's a project, an open source project called Boxball, which makes the data very easily accessible. So I know one thing, there's a learning curve with RetroSheet data. So Boxball, I highly recommend just Google it, or if you, for any of this stuff, you can come ask me. I'll be hanging out outside afterwards. And then again, thanks to Sabre and the Statistical Analysis Committee for inviting me to speak here today. Do we have a minute or two? We can take two questions if people have any. Yeah, over here.
I see you have a lot of work you did in your notebook, so, and I don't know if you're not showing stuff that you tested and didn't actually work, but I was curious whether if there's salary differentials between the two leagues. Maybe the American League is just spending more money per average player or something.
I didn't look at that. I explicitly didn't want to get into why. I just wanted to measure the difference. I know that, I can't remember which writer it was now. Somebody at Baseball Prospectus looked at that about 5 years ago. I think it was Russell Carlton. And what he found is that the AL was spending more than the NL at the time, but if you took out the Yankees, that it was equal, and that even if you took out the Yankees, like the interleague play differences were still pretty stark. So he concluded it wasn't salary. That wasn't a strong enough argument for me. I would love to look at it in light of these numbers. I don't think it's fair to just remove one team and now compare. Like, I think we know how big these differences are now. Do they match up to the differences in salary? That would be something cool to look at, but something I haven't looked at yet.
I will say that when I did mine in 2017, that was the thing that came up a lot. You know, the Yankees and the Red Sox way up here, and everybody else bubbling below them. And I think this was before the Dodgers started throwing as much money at players as they did. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Dodgers, didn't come all the way across this, but there's been
it could be. I mean, and also the NL has had a great influx of young players. And again, I mean, Acuna, Tatis, Soto, that's all the last few years. Now, again, I hesitate to say that a few players can change the entire talent pool, but, there are a number of things. You look anecdotally, and it does kind of jive with the NL doing better. So, cool. What's that?
It felt close this year, right?
And the last two or three years it has, yeah.
So is it possible that you could look at maybe deciles of players against each other in each league, like the top decile of the league versus and the second decile of the league against each other, third, fourth, all the way down to see if it is top-heavy or whether it's persistent throughout all the deciles?
That's a really good idea. I think I will take a look at that. Thanks. Cool. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, and I'll turn it over to Hans now.
This works. So this was not approved by the, was not accepted as a presentation, but Phil was kind enough to allow me to do it. I don't know if my displays are. And so, congratulations, you are possibly at the worst presentation at the state convention.
It's any consolation they rejected mine, too.
Yeah, so.
It's not a competition.
I don't know if this is going to let me, so. So, I'm not going to worry about that then. Let's do it off my phone. I'm Hans van Sluten. I do have a history of software development. I'm a software developer for 25 years professionally. I was the principal software developer at Baseball Reference for about 5 years, and I've been a senior data engineer at the Minnesota Twins for 5 seasons now, about the last 4 years. So today I'm going to talk about what is most likely the first known computer baseball simulation that had any sort of distribution. There may have been others, but I'm not aware of them, and there's no record of them as far as I know. So this simulation was created on the IBM 1620 computer in 1960 by John Burgesson, who was a mid-level programmer at IBM in Akron, Ohio. John began developing his baseball simulation in his off time in December of 1960. He refined it over the next couple of months, and then he submitted it to IBM's digital library, which back then IBM, the computers were where they made their money, and software was kind of a giveaway, and that continued to be true up until the age of Microsoft in the 1970s. So IBM didn't want to include it in the list because it was a game and computers are for serious stuff. But after some negotiations, he was actually able to include it in the IBM software library, and it Ultimately, there was probably about 500 to 200 copies distributed to customers, but some historians have said that's probably a likely gross overestimate as well. So this did not see wide release. The simulation did get some local celebrity on the radio by a guy named Reggie Kordick, KDKA Pittsburgh. He was a well-known radio personality at the time in Pittsburgh. I didn't know who he was, but apparently he was. But he would actually take printouts from this game and over a few days would reenact the games or do like play-by-play from them and kind of create games. And so that was kind of interesting. John himself was an active Sabre member. He was a frequent contributor to the Sabre L mailing list, but unfortunately he passed away in 2016 at the age of 85. He's survived by his wife, 8 children, 12 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren. So what kind of computer was he working on? This is the IBM 1620. It was a scientific computer. Due to it being relatively inexpensive for a computer at the time, which was about $90,000 to $120,000 in 1960, but IBM didn't really sell computers, they rented them. They leased them to people. And so they probably would have paid about $2,800 a month for this computer. The numbers, you're talking more like the millions of dollars to pay for these things. And they would have been paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in today's money per year, per month. It was a weird computer. It had variable word length binary coded decimal instead of what we would now consider like standard hexadecimal binary. But decimal was easier for new computer users to understand, and variable word length allowed for arbitrarily long numbers, which are useful in scientific computing. The computer had 20,000 decimal digits of memory, which was later expanded to 60,000. You can think of it as 20K of RAM, which is pretty small. It used a typewriter as well as certain front of switches to interact with it, and programs could be stored or retrieved using punched paper tape or punch cards. For comparison, it was probably most closely equivalent to home computers of the late 1970s and early 80s, like the Commodore 64, the IBM PC, other 8-bit computers of the time. But the architectures were wildly different, so that's only like kind of a rough approximation of their difference of the similarities. This caught my eye back in 2012. There was an article about him, where it's got most of my historical information, and I recommend you take a look at that if you're interested. This was something he just kind of did in his free time and ultimately never really did much with it. After that, he lived a good life, and but didn't really follow up too much. But he was a Sabre member for a long time. So in 2019, while I was researching baseball simulations, I remembered the article and decided to do some exploring on bitsavers.org, which to see if someone had saved this program that he had created. And to my surprise, I did find it there. There were some exports of the punch cards, and the game had been stored where they had been saved. Unfortunately, I couldn't make heads or tails of the data itself. I couldn't get it to work. I contacted the Computer History Museum and did not get a response, and so I just kind of said, well, all right, whatever. I'll forget about it. And then in 2020, something happened, and I was sitting at home a lot, and so I decided to start playing around with it again. I emailed them again. I didn't get a response from them, not surprisingly. But I decided to study the documentation in more detail. And what I noticed was in the documentation for the program itself, it actually had the original punch cards in coded form that I had just kind of passed off as just garbage at the end of the file or something, I guess. And so I said, well, it's not great, but I can probably start recreating it. So I started manually typing it into a text file, basically trying to transfer these characters out into a file. So how was I going to recreate this? Like, how was I going to run this after I typed all these things in? Well, this is where the Computer History Simulation Project, known as SimAge, comes in. It was created by two digital engineers to recreate the VAX hardware. But has since been, there's 60 different hardware platforms that can be run on this now. And it's basically to restore and to allow you to run like old software from these machines from the 60s and 70s and early 80s and stuff like that. So, and IBM 1620 was one of them. So, over the course of the next week, I began manually typing the decimal digits in to a text file that would, and each row of this would be a punch card for the computer. On top of that, I thought I typed it in pretty well, but you know, there were smudges on the pages. I didn't really understand what a lot of the characters meant, and so there was like eyes, and I thought there, you know, I didn't know that there were actually supposed to be bars and ones, and like the zeros and O's looked very similar, and so I honestly just couldn't get it to work. So I downloaded this book off of BitSaver. It's called Programming, Basic Programming Concepts in the IBM 1620 Computer, which was kind of like a programming manual that they would have given out to programmers back then, and basically had to learn how to program this thing from the ground up. Once I had kind of read that book, and I actually bought a copy of it off of eBay, I don't have it with me, but it's actually in pretty good condition, I was able to better understand what this code meant, and that like some of these weird symbols were a record mark, which was a special character in their system. The O's and zeros, you can see, look very similar. There's just sort of a blob of garbage in some of these areas where you're just like, what is that? and I basically just kept working through these things and trying to run it through the simulator until one day things started actually happening. And there were still weird things where like a name would get printed wrong and it would crash, and I'd try to find that name within the code itself and see like, oh, I had mistyped an O for a zero or something like that. And that just continues. And there's probably a few different things still in there. So with that in mind, let me show you. I'm using a typewriter font to kind of recreate what this would have been like. But you've got to understand that this would have been fed into a machine through a punch card machine or through a paper tape. Some switches would have been flipped, and then it would start printing out on this ream of printer paper, and you would have a typewriter in front of you that you would have been typing in. This would not be like a terminal like you would think of in a modern computer. It asks for the date and time. It doesn't matter what you type here. It's just to set the random number generator up. So we'll just say like August 19, 2022, time is 3:46. All right, so, and let me just stop the simulation briefly, because I want to give you a sense of what the throttling, it should show the throttling at what it would have been like. So there's a list of players that you can type in that are in the manual itself. And it's this weird like collection, like idiosyncratic collection of players that he was just interested in, or you know, that are familiar to you, but you know, he put himself in there, he put his brother in there, and like it's pretty idiosyncratic. And it's honestly like I haven't been able to decompile the code yet and really figure out how he's doing the simulation, but it's bad. I mean, like you'll have like 10-1 games in like the first inning. So like you would type in a name, let me just type in Cap Anson, and it would give you the year that he's doing and like the batting average that he assigned for him there. Lajoie. And you could do stuff like put Ty Cobb in every position, you know. And so it's kind of interesting. So we'll put John in the simulation because he created it. So he put himself in there. This must have been his like, you know, hometown team. Gave himself a .599 batting average. So we're going to put Hans Wagner in there because he has my name, Babe Ruth, Mike Hoff. This simulation is not running. Now, this would have typed out like, so it would have been a very slow process. And I thought I had that. Oops. I don't know who that is. I figured something out. Because if you type garbage, it'll say like no valid player, retry. But that's not working. All right, here we go. I want to give you a little bit of sense. Kill instruction. It should be at 100, but this thing is very doesn't quite work super great. So let's just set it really low, and basically just pretending to slow the machine down a little bit. And let's just put like Yogi Berra. Yeah, it's still not quite working right, but. So I'm hoping that it doesn't. All right. Now it's starting to slow down a little bit, so it's a little more realistic. But so it chose a game, or it chose a team, for the competing team, not competing team. And now it would just start typing out the game, and it would actually show like what was happening in the game. So by ejitting. And this is actually typing faster than it probably would have at the time as well, but I kind of want to give a give you a sense of it. But yeah, so he did, I mean, it was actually kind of an interesting little game. I mean, he had like Texas Leaguers and stuff like that in there. He kind of tried to make it somewhat interesting. And you can see how they would have done a play-by-play off of this on the radio. You know, you can elaborate on like what was actually happening and stuff like that. So, so this is somewhat close to the speed of what it would have run at. Let's just set the throttling to like 1,000K, and we'll just kick out. So. It'll just finish up real quick. And as you can see, and it just starts over again. There was a way, like if you swapped out the punch cards and you knew exactly how to encode the players, you could have put any players you want, you could have put all their stats. I haven't been able to do that yet, but you could have. This final score is like 9-7. I've seen like 20-1. It's a pretty bad simulation. but it's also one of the first, at least as far as we know. So. So I was able to recreate it. As you can see, like, and you can go on to bitsavers.org and get all these files, not the cards, but like here's the original manual that was printed out for it that came with it, the IBM software. They would tell you how to basically set up the computer, which flips, you know, switches to flip and everything when you wanted to plug it in. Here's the record format if you wanted to put your own, you know, players in. It would kind of tell you what your punch cards should look like. And this is where the program itself came in. Let's see. They have a sample run as well. Let me see here. There we go. So they have a sample run, and then this is the memory dump of, like, if they had loaded it into memory, and then they just dumped it out to the printer, and it would just print it out. And those are the machine codes that are telling the computer what to do. And then these are the punch cards that I was able to read. But as you can see, like, some of the, it seems like it's been copied a few times, which ended up merging stuff all together. And there's actually two versions of the program. One of them doesn't actually print all the play-by-play out and stuff like that. No type-out demo. And so that's what I was able. And this page gets really bad. That's what I was able to do. I still want to. Let me go back to this real quick. So there's a few other future things. Better understanding. I'm working on a disassembler now that will actually take the punch cards and try to convert them into like the assembly language so that I can better like create the figure out what the program would have looked like and how he was doing like the simulation. Computer History Museum has all of his archives and documents and some audio recordings from the radio, from what I understand, so that might be interesting to look at. There's another baseball simulation that came out after this. It was actually written in Fortran or some other language back then, created by Dennis Iverson. That was written for the 1960s. So but I'd like to thank Bess Kalb, wrote the article for Grantland about it, so I wouldn't have known about this if it weren't for her. Bitsavers.org, they store tons of software for legacy computers and documents and stuff like that. So they're an important archival resource for computer history. And SimH, which has allowed me to recreate the software program. So thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so John Burgesson, I mean, if his stuff should be stored in the California archive, he must have done other interesting things at IBM. Maybe I missed it, but what was his career at IBM?
My understanding is he was basically a mid-level programmer for most of his career. He did this in his free time over like Christmas, and it was common at the time because, I mean, you got to remember at the time, computers were, you know, very rare. This was a small scientific computer, but like, getting time in front of a computer is exceedingly rare. And so in the off hours at IBM, these programmers would like work on their own stuff because they're just, you know, computer nerds like me. So they would just come up with this stuff. So I'm sure he did a lot of other programs with him. He worked on this with his brother for a while. But he did have, I mean, I know he went on to work on stuff at IBM, and then he retired in like the, I want to say in the 90s. yeah, I want to say in the mid-90s, late 80s. if you read the Grantland article, it goes into how he had a conversion to Christianity, and that was kind of the more important to him and stuff like that. And so he kind of lost interest in computers and stuff. He continued to be interested in baseball. He wasn't super interested in like statistical analysis and all that stuff. Like, he was aware of it. He never really got into fantasy baseball or anything like that. But it's interesting that he, at the time, he was so interested in baseball that he did this. So, any other questions?
I was really fortunate to get any access in 1966 to a Fortran program that did a simulation. Do you know anything about the genesis? I only know that it was given by my sister at the University of Pennsylvania, who sent it to me. The two of the same. It was a big deal for me because I was lousy in the lab.
Oh, I don't know where that program came from. This was it a baseball simulation?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, there was a, I don't know if this is the same one, and this is for the IBM 1620, which is the only thing, so I'm not familiar what machine you would have been working on at the time.
I think it was UNIVAC.
Okay.
Sure.
Actually, I have a friend of mine worked on UNIVACs back then. There is, let's see here. And as you can see, there's, you know, tons of, if you're into computers and stuff like that, there's a lot of stuff here. But let's see. There is, oh, shoot. It's also sometimes hard to find. Here we go. There was another program here called, this is the catalog numbers for the IBM stuff. There was a baseball program written after this. And it may have been related to that. I think this one was written in, let's see, I'm trying to remember if this one. I think this one was written in Fortran and is a little bit more involved, but here's like how the program works. You had to write flowcharts to figure out your programs because you didn't have a whole lot of time to sit in front of a computer and program it. And I'm trying to remember, was this one in machine code too? I thought this was. Okay. Yeah, so this one I think was written in Fortran. This is probably just like the, oh. So this computer also, one thing I forgot to mention, this computer didn't have like a complex arithmetic unit. It could do addition and subtraction. And for multiplication, it actually had a table in memory that it would use to jump to figure out multiplication. I mean, it was crazy. There's like flag bits, so you could have any length of number for a number, which was good for scientific purposes. But the way it did it is like it would start at the end and it would start reading numbers until it hit this like flag bit in memory. So. But yeah, so I would guess, I mean, it may have been related to that program, but honestly, I don't know. It would have been the same time period, though.
Did this program have anything to compile a season stats?
No. This is, like, as you can see, those numbers, like, that was all hand-coded machine assembler. Like, this was all, he would have written the program, and then he would have, like, hand-figured out what digits he needed to program it, and then punched them into the punch cards. Later on with Fortran, they would do a lot of that work for you, but... Yeah, this was what I showed you was to the extent that this had functionality. And you have to remember, this thing filled 20,000 characters. That filled up the memory of this machine. There was no more room for any programming space. Yeah, this machine was later upgraded to 60K, and you would have had more room to do some interesting things with it. But yeah, I mean, that was basically the extent to which this program would have fit in memory. So not a lot of room back there.
Is there any place that we can access the revised version of
the Yeah, I can. I have it in GitHub. I can make. I think it was private, but I can make that. I can show you. I mean, it's still private now, but let's see here.
Nice avatar.
Yeah. It's in here somewhere. There it is. Yeah, it's private right now. I can make it public, but yeah, I have the configuration for SimH that basically this sets all the switches on the screen on the computer that would have been needed to do, so you don't have to worry about that, and just attaches a card reader to that file to a card reader, and then boots off the card reader, and then these are the actual cards themselves. Yeah, I'll make that available afterwards. If you just go to my, just can't pitch on GitHub. It's easy to find.
It went by really fast, but
Clippers of the U because you had a speeding machine up. But actually what you've got there is a batting order tester.
Yeah.
It's not really clear it's any more sophisticated than that, but you've got there is a batting order tester.
Quite possibly.
You put in the number of the names, you happen to pick, and you said you could use all Ty Cobbs if you wanted to use all Ty Cobbs.
Right.
That'd be kind of a wasted experiment to have all the same nine guys. But nonetheless, that's a batting order tester. Your only problem is compiling your results. You know, it showed us 9-7 for the game. We also need to see the games that come out 4-3 or 4-12 or whatever. But yeah. You're testing both batting orders in a heartbeat because your machine's a whole lot faster than the IBM 6020 was.
Well, and that's actually the reason, that's kind of why he created it, was actually to put these teams together and then say, like, well, how would these teams do against each other? And he would run multiple simulations. It would just take a lot longer back then. So, all right, well, I think I'm out of time, and there's another group coming in, but thank you very much.